I'm Megan Segura.
And I'm Eric J. Mack.
And this is The Daily Dish, Bravo's official podcast.
Megan, you're not going to believe this, but I have to tell you something.
You?
I am on a social media detox.
Eric, it's literally your job to be on social media. Yes. What are you talking about?
Okay, exactly. So that is my point. And in that, I am on social media all the time. I've made it my career, right? For probably the last decade at least. And it's something where, you know, between work and then personal, it's all just very blended. There's always, like, when I look at social media for Bravo, there's always, like, memes and everything. And then I look at my personal, it's the same thing. So there's, like, this redundancy and this just, like, urge for me to check it all the time. So I'm giving myself a certain amount of time. Like, I was actually aligning it with the UK was doing a digital detox day on September 5th. And so I was like, okay, let me give that a try. And then I was like, let me see how long I can do it, because I've always heard from Oprah that you need, and I trust her with my life, that you need 21 days to break a habit. So I don't know if I can make it a full 21 days, like, let's be real. But I thought I could at least give it like a full week of just not checking my personal social media account. So my personal Instagram and my personal Twitter. And just sort of.
So at the time of this recording, how long has it been?
Well, at the time of this recording, it's been three full days, because I deleted it on Friday the 4th, Beyonce's birthday, that evening, and then have made it now. We're recording on Monday. So,
you know what is so funny? I had the thought this morning, I feel like I haven't seen Eric post in a minute. Did he block me?
Oh my God, I would never. You always get so paranoid about these things, like that I'm attacking you. No, it's, and I did want to say it on the show too, because I know there are a lot of listeners who reach out to us all the time. And there are a bunch of people that I like have conversations with all the time in DMs about Bravo. So I'm putting it out there that I'm not, like, you know, that I'm alive and that I'm just not on social media at the moment, but I will make a return.
Okay, good. Because I need someone to send me memes, but...
Right. And I sent you some good ones in the last week or so.
You've sent me some real gems. So, but I wish you luck on this journey.
Thank you.
I feel like you're going to become a new person.
I know. I already feel a little bit lighter and a little bit less anxious, I think. So I highly recommend, if anyone feels like they need a break from that for, you know, mental health reasons, I say do it.
Yeah. But just don't take a break from podcasts ever.
No, I can't do that. It's in my blood.
Also, just a fair warning to everyone, because, you know, New York apartment buildings, there's construction going on in the apartment upstairs. So if you hear some banging, that's what's happening. Sorry. Okay, so this is a pretty big week because Real Housewives of Salt Lake City trailer dropped. Everyone has been waiting for the newest franchise, and it's here.
Perfection is attainable. Hashtag blessed on that one.
I'm a purebred pioneer Mormon.
I'm Jewish and from Chicago.
I'm actually Pentecostal.
We are Jewish by heritage, Mormon by choice.
Oh, Lord have mercy.
It is a very big deal that I'm no longer Mormon.
I was raised Mormon, but I'm converting to Islam.
Assalamu alaikum, bitches.
Woo! A good Mormon doesn't drink, doesn't have sex.
Shy, oh shy.
Nice to meet you.
I was bringing the decadence and they were bringing the depression.
Worship me. How many swans died for this?
I love this jacket because it makes me happy, not because it's Dolce & Gabbana.
Patiently, quietly, faithfully, worship me.
There's a lot of dark under the crust of perfection.
Pray for me, Winnie.
There's a lot of misrepresentations of who's friends with who in this circle.
Don't wave your finger.
She hates my guts.
Do you think you're a homewrecker?
Lisa accused me of being a swinger.
I don't judge you. I don't care enough to judge you.
This is how we do it here.
And this week we are recapping Real Housewives of Potomac. They are still at Monique's Lake House. We have Roni reunion part one, which they covered a lot of ground in just one part of the reunion. So we have a lot to talk about there. And also Real Housewives of Beverly Hills reunion part two. I mean, it is like a reunion extravaganza this week.
Reunion palooza. We also have an interview with Bravo exec Josh Brown to talk all things Real Housewives of Potomac. Also, some summer house info. So make sure to stick around for that interview.
And of course, we'll wrap up with Rose and Thorne. Also going on in the Bravo universe this week, Ashley Darby announced that she is pregnant with baby number two.
You guys have to check out her post on Instagram because baby Dean is the one who helped announce it. And it's just so cute.
I have a lot of questions.
Like what? How babies are made? I can tell you.
Well, you know, I mean, I think Ashley has said in an interview with The Dish before that she wanted to do babies like back to back. But I think my question really centers around the booty hole and how that recovery is and how that may impact her second delivery process.
Thankfully, you don't have to use the b-hole to get pregnant. So she's all good there. Also, I think I'm more interested in the timing of this announcement. I mean, Michael's going to be in some hot water this week and next.
That is very true. Guess everything's okay in the Darby house. Reunion part one, Real Housewives of New York City, go.
Yes. Okay. First of all, whenever I was telling people that I had watched virtually the filming of the reunion, everyone asked me the same question, which is, were the ladies having to scream at each other because they're so far apart? I honestly, as a viewer, don't feel like I noticed that much of a difference. I mean, visually, it's a little different, but I think overall, I didn't feel like, oh, this reunion is so different.
I agree. I mean, I loved the set, number one. I thought it was so, so cool and reminded me of like a Broadway show. I expected some like musical theater dancers to come like flying out from the wings. The only part that felt weird to me is when they cut to Andy after the commercial break and he's like looking over to the side. Like we're so used to seeing that moment of him straight on, like a shot of him just straight looking at camera. Mm-hmm. So when he was kind of like leaning to the side, I was like, oh, it looks like we're in his living room. Like we're interrupting his dinner or something.
Yeah. So, you know, we get a new Sonia this season. And like recently on her Instagram, Sonia posted, you know, a before and after photo of herself. It was like one was on the day of they shot the finale episode. And then, you know, one today. That lower facelift is amazing.
Yeah, I think she looks incredible. And I love that she totally owns it. Like if you're going to get the work done, just be transparent about it because everyone notices, right? Like you're not getting around that.
And it's only fair, I feel, to people who are looking at your social media to not just be like, oh, well, you know, I did a juice cleanse for a week and now I look like this. Like, right. No, like be honest, be real. And so I'm happy she is. Also, I love that she was sort of like, I wanted to look like Ellen Barkin for two reasons. One, that's an age-appropriate beauty inspo to have. She's not like, I want to look like Kaia Gerber, you know? Like, she wants to look like Ellen Barkin. That's great. And Ellen Barkin's beautiful. Secondly, I started watching Animal Kingdom on Amazon Prime.
Oh.
What a fantastic show. Ellen Barkin is so good in it. And I'm sure you love her because of Drop Dead Gorgeous.
Oh, yes. Of course. Yeah, I love her. And I did actually start Animal Kingdom. I watched, I think, the pilot episode. And it was one of those things that just like fell away. Like I never kept going with it, but it was really interesting.
I feel like if I ever become a mom, I want to be her character, Smurf.
I can see that just based on what I saw in the pilot. One of the things that I thought was interesting, and I feel like you and I will be able to relate to this, is there is a bit of a stigma, right? Where you spent the quarantine as a New Yorker. I think New Yorkers have a lot of pride and they have a lot of pride in the city. And there is this sort of, I don't know, idea that you should stick by the city through the ups and downs, given everything that New York has experienced, you know, since it began. And I loved that right at the beginning, everyone was kind of going back and forth about where you were. And, you know, because I feel like with everything Leah was saying, that's how I've felt. And at first I was a little bit like, when people were leaving and going out of the city and going to their parents or leaving to go some other place, I was sort of like, oh, okay, well, guess you're not a real New Yorker. You know, like there's a little bit of that.
That's so funny. Yeah. The whole conversation was interesting. Obviously, everyone was sort of, not everyone. I mean, it was really just Leah and Dorinda, but coming for Ramona in that moment and how she's sort of been handling quarantine.
You said the following on Instagram.
I am so disgusted by some of my castmates and their families who spent the entire f***ing quarantine in Florida living it up. They f***ing come back to New York and are out like nothing, not taking the seriously, and basically laughing in all of our faces. You guys, that is despicable and very day class A.
She wants to know, who were you referring to?
Well, obviously it was me, because I was the only one in Florida.
She got COVID for me, so let me explain.
And I took all precautions, so she's totally
You're
wrong.
Lying right now. What was so upsetting was the total lack of awareness in New York City. People are dying and they can't even say bye to their families. And on Instagram, you're posting, here I am with my workout, and I just upgraded to a new modern suite. Here I am. I don't even care if you don't wear a mask. I don't even care about that. It was more about the total lack of empathy of how many people are suffering in this country and the world.
It's turtle time, but it's Cinco de Mayo. Mayo.
I actually felt like all of what Leah was saying, she kept being like, it's not even about you wearing a mask or not wearing a mask. It's how you dealt with it on social media. And to me, I'm like, no, I feel like it should be the opposite. Like, wear the mask. That's like what I care about. I think it's a little, like, I get where Leah's coming from, but I also think to police how sad someone seems on social media is a slippery slope almost.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think it's a little bit of both, to your point, that it is about wearing the mask. And that is the fundamental message of this whole thing, is that it's not about you, it's about other people. And wearing the mask is to protect other people and yourself, of course. But I do get where Leah was coming in. Like, if you're representing a certain way of life on social media, people are going to see that. The other Ramonas of the world who follow her are going to see that, and they're going to be like, well, Ramona's out and about at this restaurant and taking pictures and doing this and that. And, you know, Ramona's not the only housewife to be doing this on social media, or the only, you know, famous person or people that we know. So I appreciate that Leah was calling her out for that. It didn't seem like she was breaking through to Ramona at all. And, you know, Ramona kept doubling down on like, well, I don't have COVID. I don't have it. I didn't have it. And it's like, that's not the point. You could still transfer it to someone else. You know, like, you could carry it to another person who could get sick from it. So it just didn't seem like it was really clicking in Ramona's head. So I was glad when they just finally moved on from it, because I feel like this is a conversation we've all been having for 6 months now, you know?
Yeah, it's true though. And I do feel like the whole theme of this reunion was deflection. And so you're right, like, you can't get through to Ramona when she's on the defense and she's not really taking it in.
Yeah, exactly. What did you think about Leah's story about how she got her tattoo?
Leah, please elaborate on the vagina wings.
This is actually a very crazy story, and I'm not sure you can air this.
We're ready.
When I was maybe 17 years old, I had taken hallucinogenics and I went to another dimension of the universe and I had purple wings. And when I came to, I said, I need to get this tattooed on me. And I'm like, where should I get it? The back? That's so obvious. I'm getting it on my pussy.
There's that word again.
Like, what happens when a man sees it? Like, when you're like,
oh,
let's
men
go.
Love it.
Oh, they do?
Well, by the way, in my notes, I called them the pussy wings.
I mean, that's what they are.
Yeah. I love that story. I've certainly taken mind-altering substances, and, you know, it is like a life-changing experience when you trip and see things. So I honestly get the impulse to
right.
be like, I need to remember this forever. I need to like commemorate this feeling that I had.
I want to know why she didn't want it to go to air. Was it something that her mom didn't know? Her dad didn't know? Is it something Kiki didn't know? You know, like,
I think she wasn't allowed. She wasn't sure if Bravo was allowed to say that she took hallucinogenics or that she was 17. I don't know.
Right, right. I see. Yeah. I just thought it was funny that she's like, maybe this isn't going to make it, but I'll tell the story anyway. Like, we appreciate that, Leah. Thank you for sharing.
Yes. Yes. Agreed.
Well, let's get into the whole concept of deflection, because you've already brought it up, and I feel like it was a huge through line in this part, obviously, when it comes to Dorinda and everything that they were talking with her. But I want to also start by addressing how they addressed the alcohol consumption of this season and how everyone is kind of constantly evaluating and reevaluating their relationship with alcohol. And it's sort of like everybody on that stage, really. And maybe not Tinsley and maybe not Ramona, but like Dorinda was trying to make Ramona do it. But I don't think Ramona has nearly the kind of complicated relationship with alcohol as most of the other people there.
It's so funny because I think that it is so true to life in terms of, you know, I've only lived in two places as an adult who can drink, but it was Texas and New York. And I do feel like New Yorkers have such a different relationship with alcohol than when I lived in Texas even. Because I don't know if it's the not driving. I don't know if it's because like in New York, you do have such a work mentality that it's a way of blowing off steam. But I think people go harder here, and it definitely shows on this franchise, I think, as compared to the rest of our housewives.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think even outside of New York, I think you have a really good point about that. And there is a lot of that party culture here, no matter what age you are. It's work hard, play hard. That is very much the mentality of New York City. But I think alcohol as a coping mechanism is also a very real thing for people everywhere. And, you know, Andy really doubled down on Dorinda when he was trying to get her to answer this question about alcohol and her anger and the relationship there. And she kind of was avoiding the question for a while, but he wouldn't let it go. And I appreciate that he didn't, because she kept deflecting.
Ramona, why are you sensitive about it?
Because I find it to be accusatory, maybe. I try not to point out, like, when Ramona's drinking or Ramona's sleeping with all kinds of people. I try not to point it out.
See, she can't answer the question.
Dorinda doesn't like to be told that she's had too much to drink, and I get that. I just look out for my friends because God knows I've had my issues.
I'll say that about Lou. She does. Ramona does it to harm people's reputations and to be harmful. You're a drunk. I'm angry. You're bipolar. She says she's for women, but she's not at all.
I want to talk about you.
That's
the thing. I feel like you're deflecting every time I ask this question.
Deflection. Deflection.
Okay. Just.
I can't talk with her.
Okay.
Yes, it makes me so mad because we have not had one reunion with Dorinda as a housewife where this has not been a topic. And everyone is saying to her, every woman on this couch gets crazy. It is different with you. And she is not willing to take that in. And it is. It's just different with her. She reacts differently. It's just an anger that I feel like a lot of the other ladies don't have.
Right, exactly. And there are other ways to cope with repressed anger or grief, whatever it is that Dorinda's been going through and been talking about for a long time. And I think we started to crack the shell of Dorinda, right? And she started to kind of reveal, yeah, maybe it isn't healthy. Maybe it's not the best coping mechanism for me. I'm not sure. I think there's way more there. And after watching just this first part of the reunion, I'm hoping that the next steps that Dorinda is taking in her life are to get better, you know, mental health wise. And hopefully that translates into how she deals with alcohol, what her relationship with alcohol is like. I think it affects so many things if you're not dealing with what's really going on inside. So hopefully, you know, we're starting to see in this part of the reunion a little bit more of what's going on there. But don't bring up Tinsley's name because that's going to set her off again.
I know. I mean, right before we get to Tinsley, I will say I should have kept count of how many times Andy tried to ask the question because she could not answer it without saying "we all do" or bringing up Ramona's name. We're talking about you right now, Dorinda. We'll get to everyone else, but right now we're talking to about you. Like that is so infuriating to me.
But also, why Ramona? Because Ramona does not act a fool
ever
very often when it comes to alcohol. She acts a fool in other ways.
Yes. For sure, maybe all the time, but right. It's not alcohol fueled with Ramona ever. I don't know that I've ever, except for turtle time, seen her drunk.
Yeah. And she obviously, we know she goes out all the time. She is always double booked at every time she's filming. She's always like, I got to go somewhere else. I have this other plan. So she very well could be out every single night. She probably isn't going out every single night and getting wasted, because if you take one look at Ramona at 63 years old, she looks fantastic. So if you're really abusing your body in such a way, that's going to show on you physically. And despite what Dorinda said, like, Ramona is thin. She is thin. She's healthy. She's fit. She looks really good. Her skin is great. She's probably drinking a lot more water than she is wine when she goes out all the time. So it just felt weird that Dorinda was not deflecting, because we have seen her do that a lot, but really pushing it onto Ramona in a way that was just like, why Ramona? And I guess it was in response to the things Ramona has said this season about Dorinda's drinking and saying that she needs AA and all of this other stuff. So I understand maybe why she was going in on Ramona, but like from what we've seen as an audience, Ramona's not the one to worry about when it comes to booze.
Correct. But yeah, the Tinsley part of it all.
Yeah, so this is where it gets kind of interesting, right? So I have spent a little bit of time with Tinsley, and I spent time with her around the time that a lot of this Dorinda stuff was really bubbling to the surface. And Tinsley had mentioned to me that there was a monetary exchange between John and Scott, and that was the root of the problem with Dorinda. So I had heard that a long time ago. And since that moment, I've seen both Tinsley and Dorinda separately, and I've felt from both of them a lot of tension. And Tinsley's not always one to lead with like the, this is what's going on. But in conversations that I had with Dorinda at BravoCon, there was a little bit of shade thrown. I had interviewed Tinsley at BravoCon right before I interviewed Dorinda. And when Dorinda sat down, she kind of made a comment about Tinsley. And I was like, okay, so this tension between them is very real and it's not getting any better.
Well, let's dissect this though, because it's not an if. We have the footage to back it up. John borrowed money from Scott. First of all, is Madame Paulette okay? Secondly, what does that have to do with Tinsley? It's just the fact that she knew before Dorinda?
I think there was already some kind of resentment or whatever that Dorinda had for Tinsley. And maybe it was...
I mean, it for sure is embarrassing to find out that your boyfriend borrowed money from someone else's boyfriend. I think that's pretty embarrassing.
Well, and I think maybe that's what really struck a chord with Dorinda. But what if it had been somebody else? What if it had been anybody else besides Scott? Would she have reacted the same way? And would she have treated that person's significant other, aka Tinsley, the same way? Probably not. I think it's because it was Tinsley. I think Dorinda has always felt like Tinsley wasn't giving enough to the show, that she was, you know, kind of spoiled and living off of other people's money. And we've heard that from Dorinda over the years since Tinsley's been on the show. So I think this was for her maybe a final straw. And, you know, I don't think Tinsley really wanted to get involved in that. Like, that is between John and Scott. And yes, people are in relationships and that does maybe affect Dorinda and Tinsley in some ways, but it doesn't have to. Like, you can make the choice as Dorinda to not let that affect how you view Tinsley, because what does she have to do with the whole thing? She didn't ask anybody to, she didn't tell John like, oh, sure, Scott will probably do that. It seems like that was worked out between Scott and John, and that's where that issue should stay.
Yeah, agreed. I guess I have to imagine Dorinda didn't think they would show that footage in this episode, because for her to pretend like she didn't really remember anything about this money exchange. No, we have you on camera screaming at John about this. There's no way you don't remember that.
What happened was, after we've been broken up, when we were in Miami, this was season 11, you and I got in this horrific fight that was not on camera, because I had told you that Scott had generously given John some money that you did not know about. You,
I don't know about that.
Felt
I don't deal with Scott.
I
know he did a commercial
he's
with you.
Generous.
I don't know what we're talking about, John, but the betrayal
that you felt from John manifested itself into anger towards me. You took it out on me.
You called John screaming.
The producers wanted me to not stay in the house that night because you were going so crazy. They were actually worried about my safety. You turned on me that moment when you found out John had that money. And that is what happened.
I never got involved with John's finances.
Is it because he gave John the money? Is that why you're mad? Well, you had a huge fight about it in Miami.
You called John saying, don't use my friend to ask for money.
You don't run game behind my back ever. I don't want you to talk to Scott. He is not your friend. So what I say to you, don't do something, you better well listen.
I remember that phone call. We were traveling. We're in Miami.
That unseen footage was in the trailer for last season's Real Housewives of New York City. And I remember a lot of people being like, where did that scene go? Because, you know, fans are obsessed and they pay attention to everything. And it seemed like such a huge, explosive, important moment that for it to not appear in the season, everyone was like, what the hell? So I don't know if that was just some kind of really smart foresight from a producer who was like, let's sit on this for a little bit longer because we may need to use this later on. But it really did come in handy at this reunion.
I know, because I had been preparing for last season's Real Housewives of New York after show. And so to do so, they were giving us early cuts of episodes. And it was in one of the early cuts. And then I was like, oh, they took it out. I wonder why. I mean, it could have been that Dorinda was like refusing to talk about it outside of that phone conversation that got filmed. But we need a Roni exec to tell us what happened there.
I know, that's so true. I mean, I'm so glad that we had Tinsley back for this reunion, and watching her, I do miss her a lot on the show, but a lot of the things that they were talking about and the way Dorinda was talking to her and the way, you know, when she was looking around and she was like, not everybody here was super supportive of me getting back with Scott. So like, I feel like she maybe didn't feel as though she had a place on the show anymore, and her place in her life, which she says, I'm not talking about the show, I'm talking about my life. So maybe she just felt, I gotta go. I don't know who has my back here really, except for maybe Leah and like maybe, I don't even know who it was, like Sonia. But I kind of felt bad for her. I kind of understood exactly why she felt like it's time for me to move on.
I do feel bad for her, but I also have to speak up on behalf of the friend who has to constantly watch someone getting back together and breaking up and getting back together and breaking up. It's exhausting. And it's just not fun to be on the sidelines of that. And by the way, I do have worries about their relationship. I know they're engaged. Engaged doesn't mean married. We'll see.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I'm not placing any bets either way. I really wish Tinsley the best and Scott and their little family with the cute little strawberry and shortcake. I hope everything works out. But I understand why Tinsley didn't want to talk about where she was with Scott, because she did feel like she was going to just get shot down by all of her friends, which they pretty much all did. So she kind of proved them right, or proved herself right in that situation. So I think all in all, it's just good to see Tinsley move on and move forward with Scott, which is what she's wanted for a really long time. And I hope that in some ways, you know, we can keep up with her on social media or whatever it may be. But like, I'd really love to get more of a glimpse at her life in Chicago. Like, could we do a Roni spinoff of Tinsley, like in her Chicago life, right? Wouldn't that be kind of fun? Well, so obviously before we get into the Real Housewives of Beverly Hills recap, we should probably address the fact that Denise announced she's leaving the show.
I mean, are you surprised?
Not one bit. But I also have to say that I think it's a bit of a boss move to have your rep announce it as opposed to doing it yourself on, say, Instagram, or making it come from yourself, you know?
Yeah, like, I mean, because she didn't release a statement. I don't think she's put it on her social. Like, she's not even acknowledged it. So, yeah, it's almost like I can't be bothered to even formally resign. You know what I mean?
It's a bit of an afterthought for her, right? She's like, it's 2 years anniversary with Aaron from, you know, getting married. She's working in Europe right now. She's just kind of like, oh, by the way, like telling her publicist, like, can you just let everybody know I'm not coming back to the show?
Lisa Rinna is probably so happy.
I think there are probably a couple cast members that are happy about that.
Yeah. So getting into Real Housewives of Beverly Hills, this reunion part two, I got really sad watching the Kyle and Dorit conversation. We found out that they have not been talking.
Kyle, this is very important because you are very important to me. And it's hurt me a lot that from after the first episode, you've just blanked me. You and I have never had a relationship where we don't speak for months and months on end. And you
are
have
you
been
not
in the
speaking
press
right
and very
now?
Vocal on Twitter and in the press that you're very upset at me, thinking that I slammed your business.
I know. That is true. I kind of did like their friendship, and they had a really strong one for a while.
I mean, I think they're so good when they're friends, but at the same time, it's like I understand both points. If I was Kyle, I'd be pissed if I heard what Dorit was saying in her confessionals, because it didn't sound like poking fun. It sounded like deep-seated anger that someone who doesn't know what they're doing is putting on a fashion show. But by the way, I get it, because the footage is sort of embarrassing of Kyle not knowing what pieces were there. Like, do you have business doing that? You know what I mean? Like, someone like Dorit has experience and has the know-how, as she said, like to do all of that. So I don't know. Like, I remember Bethany made this point. I was rewatching the season where it was Bethany versus Carol at the reunion. And Bethany was kind of criticizing Ramona by saying, you're making it seem like, and look how easy it is, you know, to just put out a product. She's like, it's not easy. It takes a lot of skill, a lot of work ethic. And she was like, and so I don't respect people who just slap their name on things.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think Dorit, her criticism was legitimate. And I don't even think she was that angry about it, but she was a little bit more like, I expected more of Kyle. That someone who was opening a show at New York Fashion Week, that Kyle would have walked in with a little bit more preparation, because not only were there those things going on when she was looking at all the different designs, but I think once they were at New York Fashion Week and the show was coming together, she was also fighting with the woman backstage who was like, oh, we need to do it this way. And Kyle's like, no, I need to add these two people in to walk. Like, I want them to walk in the show. And the woman was like, we are all producing like this extremely complicated, very perfectly timed event, and now you're just throwing a wrench in because it's what you want. Like, it seemed a little bit that Kyle was disconnected from the whole experience. And I feel like Dorit is someone who, when she has a project at hand, she fully immerses herself in, whether it's, you know, it's like bikinis or Buca di Beppo. Like, she is all in on whatever project she's working on. So I think she had a fair point, like you said, about being a little bit more critical of the way Kyle handled it all, because Dorit knows what kind of work goes into it. Now, the other thing that's interesting about Kyle, and this comes up in the conversation with Denise, where Kyle had called her a ragamuffin and Denise seemed pretty unbothered or whatever, but that Kyle waited to reach out to Denise until after there was social media blowback. And I think this is a pattern of Kyle, where she is very reactive to what fans say on social media, and then she takes action from it, which I kind of understand, you know, as people who host a podcast, sometimes I'll look into what fans are saying and try to listen to what, you know, the themes or sentiment is around certain things and kind of step back and think, oh, okay, that's an interesting way to look at it, or I didn't see it that way. So obviously that kind
of... Yes, you can course correct.
Yeah, well, yeah, I mean, that kind of feedback is important. But when it comes to personal relationships with your friends, with women on the show or whatever, waiting until you see how fans might react to something to then decide how you're going to deal with it is, I don't know, I feel like it's a little bit different, right?
Yeah, like it goes two ways. Like, one is you want people to watch themselves and to hear criticisms and to take it in and change a little bit, you know? But you also want them to, on their own, be like, oh, I said that in a fit of anger and I kind of sound like an asshole.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, and they brought it up in the first part of the reunion, how someone had told Garcelle, watch out, you know, Kyle will, she uses social media to sort of get people on her side and then, you know, they'll come after you type of thing.
That's true.
So I do think that Kyle's very into the social media.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. Speaking of Garcelle, this whole issue with her and Lisa Rinna, I want to break this down a little bit, because one of the things that Teddy said in this conversation that I didn't really stand by, and it's because there is a deleted scene featuring Garcelle from that moment. So when Garcelle brings up the whole issue of Rinna dancing and how it might affect Amelia, and it's in front of the whole group, everybody's there. Now at the reunion, Teddy says, we were all having like a very light conversation, Garcelle, and then you took it there. You took it to that kind of darker place and it just didn't seem appropriate. Well, what Teddy left out is that Garcelle also opened up during that scene about her son's struggle with addiction. So it wasn't like they were just in the middle of having this like really fun conversation and then all of a sudden Garcelle was like, let's get deep and real, and just went after Rinna. I think, as it does with conversations with groups of people, sometimes you get into the more serious things that people are going through in life. So I think to not see that scene, for viewers to not see that scene, which they have aired it actually, and when they do like the never before seen added episodes that air sometimes, there is that scene in there. But I didn't like that Teddy was kind of trying to be like, oh, Garcelle, you were out of line, because I think Garcelle also opened up about what her family was struggling with. So it's a little bit different in that context, right?
Yeah, that makes sense.
The other thing that I wanted to mention, and this was from a listener that reached out, Courtney Hurley 87, about the concept of thin privilege. And basically, thin privilege is the unspoken advantages of existing and navigating the world in a thin body. So for example, your health isn't always up for debate, or you can always find your size in major department stores. So I think when we talk about what Amelia and Lisa Rinna had talked about in their conversation about, you know, being thin or being too thin and criticism of like body size and things, there is this sort of added layer to that conversation of you also, you know, as a thin person, have a certain advantage or privilege over people who are not built the same way. So I think that is just something that I had never really considered before, and I thought was kind of interesting in this conversation around Rinna and her body and how she presents it and how Amelia might feel as a residual effect, not even like Lisa Rinna's dancing on Instagram causes Amelia's problems, but how it might feed into that in some ways, you know?
Yeah, it's definitely good to keep in mind.
And don't you think that maybe Amelia should not be going into modeling at this point? Like, maybe a new career path is better?
I mean, that's definitely been something that I've thought about for sure. I think even the healthiest of self-esteems is not great in that industry. You know, you're constantly being told to change something.
Right, exactly. And I think there is a lot more body positivity coming out through models these days. When you look at like Rihanna and Savage Fenty, she's using all different types of models of all different, you know, races, body sizes, everything. So I think the industry itself is starting to shift a bit, but I think when you see your body like that all over the place and you're taking these shots, I feel like it is an opportunity to fall into feeling bad about yourself or feeling more critical. You know, I just feel like it's a bit of a dangerous path to go down.
Absolutely. Also, is she really making more money than all the housewives with the modeling? Because I'm sure she's successful, but I mean, is she a Gigi Hadid?
To afford that kind of rent, I was pretty surprised that she's paying for that all on her own. Like, that's a lot.
I know. I did the math. It's $68,000 a year in just rent.
Well, I guess, you know, a couple modeling gigs will get you upwards of that. You know, we picked the wrong career path, Megan.
Yeah. Podcasting is not so lucrative, it turns out. So, okay. I always watch episodes of things a couple of times, like once for like my other like show producer duties, but then I'll do it again for the podcast. I had to literally fast forward Teddy telling the story of her daughter's finger being,
oh my God,
severed. I can't even talk about it. It was making me sick to my stomach. It was so graphic.
I was taking the trash out and Slate went to kind of follow me outside the front door. A gust of wind came and the front door slammed on her finger and amputated the tip. And
you had to pick the finger off the floor?
Yes.
Oh.
So what'd you do with the finger?
So I wrapped her hand and then I put the finger on ice and then I was on the phone with 911 and the first thing they said was, you didn't put the finger on ice, did you? And I was like, yes. And they're like, take it off ice and just wrap it in gauze and put it in a Ziploc. So yeah.
Wow.
It's so, so gnarly. Like the whole story is just out of control. And I love that her daughter was not really fazed by it at all. Kids are pretty resilient with these things. Like if that had happened to me, I would be distraught like for months afterwards. Like there's no way.
Right? Like I would be milking it every day.
Just, I mean, between that story and then everything Teddy's going through with Dove, with the neurosurgery she had to go through, which by the way was a success. Dove is fine. And we've also learned recently that Teddy is back on birth control, which I have to say, I cannot blame her with everything she's been through in the last year. I like, that is enough to get you back on birth control, everything she's gone through.
Well, also, I don't know if you know this, but women are like at their most fertile right after they've had a baby. What kind of sick joke is that? That your body is like, hey, you just did this thing that is just trauma to your vagina. Let's go through the whole thing again right now.
Yeah, she's like, hell no, I can't deal with any more severed fingers, neurosurgery, like nothing. Like, I need some time.
Absolutely.
Okay, let's get into this whole Denise, Brandy, Rinna situation that we've found ourselves in. I have a question for you as it relates to this. Do you have any acquaintances that you are in touch with but wouldn't consider a friend?
There's someone who comes to mind because it's more of like an Instagram friendship where it's like we've hung out through friends a couple of times, but they message me a lot via Insta. And I don't know if it's so I'll respond back, you know, because I don't want to be rude, but it's also a weird thing where I'm like, well, we're not friends. Like, we don't know each other, you know?
Exactly. No, I think nowadays it's much more common to be in touch with people that you would not say, oh, that's one of my close friends, or we hang out all the time. But you could probably describe them or say nice things about them if you're asked at BravoCon, for example, and you've had a lot of media training and you don't want to sound catty or whatever it may be. And so when you're asked about this person that you may be in touch with, you're probably going to say a handful of nice things and move on from that, right? Like,
oh, I see what you're doing. You're tricking me into being on Denise's side. Well done, Eric.
Well, I mean, so that's kind of what I'm bringing it back to this moment where I think, and I've said this all season long, is that Denise is a professional when it comes to this industry that she's in. So I feel like they're really drilling her on this like friendship with Brandy and this relationship that they have. And even if it's true that they had sex once, twice, three times, that does not mean that they are like best friends, right?
They're not winning any argument by saying, look at what good friends they are. Because you can be great friends with someone and still not have sex with them. Or, you know, it doesn't, one doesn't equal the other.
Right, exactly.
I think, though, I will say that a strong point that Rinna made is no matter what your relationship is, why wouldn't you call Brandy in Italy and ask her about this?
Why didn't you just call Brandy in Rome and say,
because she's not a friend of mine, Lisa. She's not.
She's not a friend of yours?
She is not a friend of mine.
Like, because I would. If you said to me, oh, this person that you kind of sort of know said that you guys had sex, I'd be like on the phone with them in 2 minutes and be like, you said what? You know, like, I don't think that whether you're friends or not would impact whether you make that phone call.
I wonder if Denise at that point in Rome had already decided she was going to take legal action. So at that point, no more contact. And especially not, you know, especially not over the phone where you can't document anything. You can't record someone. That's illegal in most places. So it's not like she could call Brandy and be like, why did you say that? And then record it and use that against her. But I definitely think we saw the wheels turning in Denise's mind in Rome. And instead of calling Brandy and being like, why would you say that? I think she was like, I need to call my lawyer. I need to call my publicist. I need to get this stuff ready. I think she had made the call to get a cease and desist back then.
But alternatively, it could have been because she knew it was true. And at that point is like, I can't have contact with Brandy because
that'll look more suspicious. The other thing about Denise, too, is they were all really demanding that she reveal who this other person in the group is that Brandy has claimed to have had sex with. And everyone was collectively pushing her to do it, except for, I think, like Dorit and Garcelle.
I was, too. I'm watching like, just say it, just say it.
But doesn't that make her then no better than Brandy for putting everyone else's business out there? I mean, she could have.
Not if they are saying, tell, like, we're okay with you revealing it.
Right, because whoever it was would have denied it anyway, just like Denise is doing.
I just think it reminds me of the whole Kim Richards, like, you don't want me to say, like, what's, you know, what what I know about your husband, Lisa Rinna. And she's like, you can tell me. You can say what it is. What's the thing you heard? And like for her to be like, nope, I won't do that to you. It's like, yeah, because you have nothing. You're a liar.
Right. Well, in that instance with Kim, right, she didn't actually have anything on Harry Hamlin and just wanted to egg her on. So maybe Denise still doesn't have anything. I mean, for all we know. But the other layer to that is these text messages that allegedly exist between her and Rinna, which my imagination has run wild with the thoughts of what is in those text messages with Rinna. I don't think that they'll get revealed in part three. I feel like that's a slippery slope then for Rinna and Denise to go down. So I would love to know what's in there, but I'm not sure we're going to get it.
Hope we do. Yeah.
So Real Housewives of Potomac, we love a group trip, right? That is the best part of Housewives when they're all together and they're doing something like a group trip. What I want to know about you, Megan, is what is your duty when you are out with friends on a trip somewhere? What is your role that you take on? Because what I do is breakfast. I love taking on breakfast makers so I can get my responsibility done early in the day. And then like, I'm good.
You're making me think I may not be a good person to take on a trip because I'm
bartender, yeah, you know?
I was going to say, I think I'm the person who's like, we need to buy alcohol. Like, I think that's my, you know, know thyself. I'm not going to be whipping up like a breakfast or a dinner for everyone, but I can get everyone nice and drunk. And I feel like that's just as valuable a skill.
Absolutely. I mean, someone has to be in charge of the errands, the supplies, the alcohol, the food, like getting the items to the home or wherever you're staying. So that's a hugely important role.
Yeah. And also, I feel like I'm also just the bone collector on trips. Tell me your deepest, darkest secret.
Well, then you are the Giselle of this trip, yeah. Because she is the bone collector and brought that information about Karen right to Wendy without question. I mean, that's what we love about Giselle, right? I mean, where would we be without her?
Yeah, that's what we love about Giselle, and that's what Karen hates about Giselle.
I also think that we should initiate a drinking game for Potomac where we drink every time Wendy says PhD.
No, we will die, Eric.
Within the first 20 minutes, yes, of an episode.
It's too much. Like, it's too much. Also, like, yes, I'm happy for you, but it's fine.
But just like I have, like I said, I have a Bachelor of Science. I'm going to start telling people that all the time.
You should. I really wish you would.
Also, do you think that Candace is the Luann of Potomac because she finds every opportunity possible to sing?
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday. Yeah.
To me, the talent needs to be entertaining and original. And obviously the birthday song is one that Candace has sung on many occasions.
You know what? I think that makes a lot of sense, actually. And also because I do know that her singing is sort of a point this season. Like, we'll definitely be seeing more of it.
Mm-hmm. At least she can.
I don't know which is worse to me. I don't know which is more insufferable, hearing about someone's multiple PhDs every 2 seconds or hearing someone sing and talk about their music career every 2 seconds.
Right. Well, I guess you'll get a fair amount of both this season on Potomac. Yeah. Sorry, but you're in for it. Well, okay. Speaking of Candace, she gets these text messages that are blowing up Michael's spot, understandably so. But like, damn, Michael.
The woman who texted me is a very good friend of mine. She works at an establishment where she has a friend who witnessed Michael asking random women to come back to his hotel with him. I've had enough drama with Ashley, with the Darbys as a whole. I don't want this.
What is Michael thinking? You should be a saint this season. After the season you had last year and the fact that you're back this season, I would be... It's also like Dorinda. If you've been called out so hard for your drinking, why not come back and show everyone I don't need to get sloppy? Like, that's a problem that he's can't just be good, you know?
He took the first opportunity where Ashley and Baby Dean were out of the house to misbehave. And that says, I think, a lot about someone's character. And it's just totally unfair to Ashley and Dean. But also, Michael, do you not recognize that you're probably going to get caught by somebody.
Yes.
No matter where you are. Like, how does he not think of that?
You no longer have the privilege of anonymity. You know, people know who you are.
And he's a very distinct looking person. Like, you're going to see
him. He got a weird little face.
Like, you will notice a Michael Darby entering the room. There are some people that just have that look where you're like, I know who that is. And especially if you're just in that area and you're in places that you shouldn't be, like, strip clubs and casinos and whatever, like, someone's going to catch you. Just, I don't understand how he doesn't anticipate.
But also, what kind of game does he have? That he has Ashley, who's beautiful, and then he's able to just walk into a strip club and walk out with someone.
Well, you know, obviously from the texts, the pictures that come out, it's people who are opportunistic. And, you know, not to say that he has a right to do what he did, because he doesn't. But there are plenty of people who would like to get also their 15 minutes and will be quick to expose you if you're willing to go down that road. But he lets himself be way too willing to go down that road all the time. So, you know, he gets exactly what's coming to him. Sorry. And I just feel bad for Ashley and for baby Dean too, because he's young and he doesn't know. But, like, ultimately down the road, these kind of actions will probably affect him in some ways.
Yeah. It's not just Ashley. He's deceiving.
Yeah, exactly. He's got a family now. He's got to think of it like that.
On the subject of Potomac, I got to interview Bravo exec Josh Brown. He's VP of current production on shows like Real Housewives of Potomac, Below Deck, Med, and Summer House. Obviously, there have been some explosive seasons of all these shows, and I asked him all about it. Here's that interview. So we know how much our podcast listeners love interviews with Bravo execs. So I wanted to welcome Josh Brown, who's VP of current production at Bravo. Welcome to the podcast, Josh.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
So being VP of current production sounds fancy. A lot of people out there who don't work at Bravo have no idea what that means. Can you explain what your job is?
Yeah, I guess it's basically being like the executive in charge of a certain number of series. So I have the good fortune right now to be overseeing Below Deck, Mediterranean, Real Housewives of Potomac, Summer House, and Backyard Envy.
That's quite a great list of shows. How did you get into this world? Like, what led to your current job here?
Well, I actually come from a filmmaking background and a television making background. You know, I've made my own films. I've made my own documentaries and TV shows. I made a documentary called The Man Who Would Be Polka King, which is on Netflix. Small plug there. which got turned into a scripted feature starring Jack Black and Jenny Slate, which was really exciting. So I've worked in film and television. I've worked in kind of all the positions, you know, kind of all the way up the line. I've done sound, I've done camera, I've done, you know, I've been a production assistant, I've directed, I've produced, and I've written. So I kind of have a feel for, you know, what goes into making things. And, you know, I've always loved comedy. I've always loved things that are funny. That's kind of my background. So I got into working on Bravo shows that way, you know, just because I find the humor just so amazing. So in the modern Bravo era, the first series I worked on was Real Housewives of Atlanta. And so I started working as an editor on that show. And, you know, I had a ton of fun. And so I kind of came up, you know, through that world and made my way to Bravo eventually.
What would you say are some of the Real Housewives of Atlanta moments that maybe people would know, would associate with you and your time on that show?
Well, this is old school. So maybe there's some old school Atlanta fans out there who remember, you know, things like from season two and that era. You know, I was involved with the Mother's Day brunch. I believe it was Candy's Mother's Day brunch, where Nene was really funny. I was involved with the conflict between Sheree and Marlo on the trip to South Africa.
Exactly.
I still can't get that out of my head. And some of the early recording of Don't Be Tardy, the original, the actual song recording with Kim,
That's iconic.
Which was, yeah, I feel like I was, you know, a witness to history there. It was amazing. It was a lot of fun. So I really enjoyed it. And I've worked all over the industry, but I kept coming back to Bravo just because it was so fun to work on.
And before we move on to your work on shows that are currently on air, I just need to call out, because you had mentioned this before and it stuck with me, that you were there for the ridiculous stripper on Real Housewives of Atlanta.
No, I was not there, but I did work with the footage. I've seen the raw footage.
Felt like you were there.
Yeah. So, yeah, there's certain things you can't unsee.
That's amazing. Probably just my favorite anecdote. So let's move on, because I need to talk about this season of Below Deck Med. Everyone, I mean, the Twitterverse is afire right now, as you've probably seen. Although I do have to wonder, how much are you paying attention to social media on your shows? Like, do you put it out there in the universe and sort of let go and let God? Or are you very invested in knowing how fans are reacting?
I would love to be on social media all the time, sort of monitoring the fan reaction, because I think you learn a lot, but I just don't have time. So I'm on there. I check in. I'm aware of, you know, what people are saying, but I'm not looking at every tweet and every post and comment on Instagram. But I'm definitely aware this one is controversial and there's a lot of talk. And, you know, even in my own world, you know, I'm getting texts from my cousin at 1 a.m, you know, saying, oh my God, I can't believe what just happened, you know, like that kind of thing. So people are really affected by the events this season. It's, you know, I knew it would be explosive, but I didn't expect the reaction that we're getting. It's actually pretty overwhelming, to be honest.
I know that you know, these people on a personal level. Are you able to stay neutral when you are working on the show and overseeing everything? Or do you find yourself watching back cuts and taking sides?
You might ask them, actually. You know, they would, you know, be the ones who'd be watching and, you know, sort of wondering if, oh, like, what about this decision? What about that decision of what to include?
Right.
I do honestly feel that I can take my personal feelings out of it and watch it as a viewer to be able to, you know, help the production company sort of give them a sounding board for their ideas. I do feel like I can. I always say everybody's greatest strengths is also their Achilles heel. One personality quirk I guess I have is that I sort of feel empathy for everyone. And, you know, whether they're an amazing person or a person that has, you know, some difficulties or what they're going through. So, you know, I feel for someone, even if they're, you know, having a moment on a series that might appear to people as sort of, you know, villainous or going through some difficult times. I really feel for everyone. So, you know, I think it's really important always in these shows to give everybody's point of view, you know? And so we really try and do that. We really, you know, I think black and white conflicts where one person is clearly in the right and one person is clearly in the wrong are sort of the least interesting conflicts in terms of storytelling. Like, we really like when the viewer gets a feel for both sides of a conflict.
Well, one thing that, you know, people can't help but take a side on is this whole Hannah situation and being fired this season. At what point did you find out what was happening? I just wonder from a filming standpoint, because we see Sandy get this text and it seems like the middle of the night. And then the next morning she's confronting Hannah. At what point are you being told what's happening?
Well, that one is a very particular case because, you know, because it was a violation of maritime law and certain things, you know, had to be sort of put into effect. So that one, you know, we at the network were very aware of very quickly. I mean, you know, probably within the hour. So there were discussions about, you know, what had to be done in terms of protocol and maritime law and that sort of thing. You know, one misconception I really want to try and address is, you know, I do see on social media that there's this perception that Hannah's firing was somehow scripted. And that is, you know, 100% not the case. You know, in fact, you know, we're really upset to see Hannah go in this way in the middle of the season. You know, no one wants to see a cast member who's been on the series for, you know, almost five seasons to leave in that manner. It's sad. We were upset and everyone on the production was upset. But that's how it works in maritime law, and we really had no option. So I think that's important for people to know.
I feel like nothing has ever seemed less scripted. I mean, even the look on Hannah's face when she realizes Captain Sandy has like followed her into the bathroom. I mean, it was a visceral feeling.
Yeah,
I agree. Hate, but nothing has ever seemed less scripted.
I completely agree. The part that feels so documentary to me, and you know, I come from a documentary background, is, you know, even before that, when Hannah gets called into Sandy's office and Sandy asks her to sit down, and she kind of glances over and sees the photo on Sandy's phone, and you see kind of a look of worry in Hannah's eyes.
Yeah.
And then she tries to gather herself. That affects me every time I see the episode, and I've seen the episode a lot.
Yeah, I imagine. How many times are you watching an episode before you get the final product?
It depends on the series, but, you know, on Below Deck Med, I might see it, you know, five times before the finished product. So it's a lot. You know, that sort of speaks to how good the show is, because it's pretty much every cut I watch is really entertaining. So even if I've seen it four times already, I'm still enjoying myself, you know, for the most part.
What an amazing job. Like, so many people out there would kill to have your job. You're just, you know, watching episodes, whittling them down, making them greater. Like, sounds amazing.
It sounds good on paper, in theory. yeah. No, but it is amazing. I feel really fortunate. Yeah, and to work on such great shows with great storytellers, I feel really lucky.
So now you guys are in the situation where you know Hannah has to leave the boat. How much then is really on Captain Sandy to find someone new versus casting at Bravo?
First of all, Bravo doesn't cast. Anyone who comes to a Bravo show, you know, comes to us from a production company. And, you know, production companies are always looking for organic circles of friends and, you know, people who are organic to the world, who are real. And in this case, you know, it's real yachties that are being, you know, put on the yacht who come to the show. So certainly, you know, Captain Sandy has an input, but it's sort of it's a collective decision, you know, based on resumes and experience and that sort of thing. Yeah, nobody is being cast onto the boat. These are people who, you know, the type of people that Captain Sandy would want to work with, who Captain Sandy would feel like, you know, has the right experience for this size boat and these types of charters.
Is there ever a struggle where she wants someone because they're really skilled and you're thinking, oh, but they have zero personality. This is not great for a docuseries.
No, we don't really get into that type of conversation with Captain Sandy. You know, it's we're really focused on resumes and on finding the right combination of people. It's not about, you know, sort of individuals. It's about the group. You see on deck, you know, I'm sure Captain Sandy would say the same thing. You always want to have, you know, someone who's more experienced and then someone who's, you know, maybe more of a learner, but really enthusiastic. So it's, you know, like any team, you want to find like a good combination of people.
And it seems like Malia's boyfriend, Tom, was just a gift from God, because at first he comes onto the boat and as a fan, I'm just like, he's a little milquetoast, like he's a little too dry. There's not going to be much drama. And then, whoa, it just comes out immediately.
Yeah, that's another one. You know, as soon as we heard about Tom visiting, and then, you know, when Kiko was unfortunately had to leave the boat, I knew. I said, everyone is going to think this is scripted. But that is so far from the case. It was pure luck. And we were very lucky, because the one person you can't go to sea without, well, I guess the captain, but the second person is the chef. I mean, you can't go out to sea if there's no food. I mean, food is probably the most important thing on the boat after safety for the charter guests. So I actually don't know what we would have done if we hadn't been able to find a chef, and we were scrambling. You know, the production was scrambling. if Tom hadn't come along, I actually don't know what we would have done. We might have had to delay the rest of the charter season. I don't know. We've never had that come up so suddenly with the chef. So the fact that Tom happened to be visiting, you know, and he was visiting on purpose because he knew that Malia was having the crew day off that you see on the show where they went to the beach club, I believe it was.
Right.
So he was purposefully visiting then. So he knew that he could spend time with Malia. But Sandy told me, she said, you know, he didn't even bring his knives. You know, an amazing super yacht chef like Tom would always bring his knives if he were planning to cook.
Right.
His big kitchen knives. He did not. He was planning to go back to the UK. And, you know, unfortunately, he had a sick relative at the time who he was planning to visit. So this was pure luck. And actually, you know, I get the sense that he needed to be convinced a little bit by Malia. I think he was doing Malia a favor and doing Sandy a favor.
Yeah. I mean, you can kind of see it that the night that the guests are complaining about the lobster, it's not just that he regrets taking the job. He regrets taking a job that's being filmed for the world to see. And that is such an interesting layer to all of this, I think.
Yeah. I mean, Tom is an amazing chef. And he's really a perfectionist. And I think, you know, it was really important to him for everyone to see, you know, his craft and how good he is. And I think Tom does work freelance in the industry, in the yachting industry. And, you know, he does come in these sort of fixer situations, from what I understand. I think he's kind of like, you know, Mr. Wolf. From
yes,
from Pulp Fiction. If ever, yeah. Anyone has ever seen that, he comes in and he fixes problems. So, you know, but he wants to be able to have all the tools and resources that he needs to be able to succeed. So the right equipment, he needs time to get the galley organized. He needs the right provisions. And I think, you know, it stresses him out when he doesn't have that, which I can understand. You know, someone who has a real dedication to their craft, they need to have certain things to be able to, you know, to kill it.
Something about this show that I think is unique from the other Bravo shows is how much the cast changes each season. You know, on Housewives or even a Southern Charm or a Summer House, we might get one new person a season, but it's not as drastic of a shift as it always is with this show, but somehow it still always works. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think it's because it's true to the industry. I mean, yachting is a freelance industry, and captains and people who staff up the yachts, they're constantly needing to find new people. So that's how it really works. And this show is a reflection of that. You know, I always feel like that is one thing that we've learned on Below Deck Med, and I'm sure have been learned on other iterations of the franchise, that, you know, the show is like a boat, like it just keeps moving forward no matter what. So I feel like when in doubt, we just have to go with it and keep moving forward, you know, and try not to get attached to things, because that's not how the yachting industry works.
Well, I want to move on to Real Housewives of Potomac, because it's a show that I have been watching and loving from the beginning. And I feel like this season in particular, we've talked about this, I watched it all in one weekend. I just think it's such good TV. Have you worked on Potomac from the beginning?
Yes. It's another show that is really near and dear to my heart. I've worked on it from the beginning. I came to the show when it was still in development, and they asked me to work with the development team, you know, to sort of investigate that this, you know, really wonderful organic circle of friends. I heard it was down in Maryland, and they said it's in this place called Potomac. And by amazing coincidence, that is where I grew up. I grew up in the Potomac area, and Potomac and Bethesda and Rockville. So that kind of blew my mind. It felt like, oh, this was meant to be. And so I've been there from the beginning. I met, you know, the original cast way back when, you know, Giselle and Karen and Robin and Charisse, and then, you know, later on, Ashley and Katie. Yeah, it's been an amazing ride.
Now, from what I remember, this was first shot as just an ensemble show, and it wasn't necessarily going to be a Real Housewives. What ended up being the thing that made everyone at Bravo say, no, this needs to be a Real Housewives of Potomac.
Yeah, you know, Bravo was always looking for real groups of friends. I think that's the key to the success of these types of shows. I mean, you really feel the history between people like, you know, Karen and Giselle or Robin and Giselle. Those types of friendship histories, you can't make that stuff up. That's why it's, you know, unscripted is so great. And so there was no sort of, you know, direction from Bravo, like this has to be a Housewives. It was like, let's go investigate and see if this group of friends, if there really could be a show, you know, grouped around them. And so we checked it out and the production company, you know, began filming. You know, the day came when, you know, word came down from on high that it was going to be a Real Housewives, you know, Real Housewives of Potomac. I remember we told the cast and we only told them, you know, maybe, you know, 45 minutes before the show got announced. And I just remember what an exciting moment it was. You know, when a show is a Real Housewives, it just gives it a lot more attention. Just because
absolutely.
Of obviously a lot of fans of the franchise and you know, a lot more of a chance for success. So that was a lot of fun.
There's so much drama in all of our shows, but particularly this one. And I just feel like whether it's a big thing or a small thing, these women are sort of sleuths. They're always trying to get to the bottom of something, you know, whether it be, does Karen really live in her house, or why doesn't Giselle have Jamal on, you know, at gatherings? How often are you getting calls from these ladies trying to figure things out?
They don't call me to try and figure things out. I do speak to them, you know, pretty frequently, but, you know, not, I try not to get involved with story. So that's not really what we talk about. They might call for other things, but I'm sleuthing along with them. So they're definitely doing their own thing. But they are, you know, I think what makes this cast so incredible is that, you know, they're really smart, they're really funny, and they're really real. They keep it real, and they're just in touch with their, you know, their emotions, and they're able to look at themselves. So that, you know, the sleuthing is about being smart and about being funny and about being self-aware. And, you know, they have all three of those qualities.
So what is it that they're calling you about? It's just usually, us talking, Josh.
Usually other smaller things, let's say. You know, there's always little things that come up from time to time. You know, I'm their connection to the network. So there might be, you know, other things they need to talk about, let's just say.
Got it. I feel like the big thing we need to talk about is obviously this physical altercation that happened this season between Candace and Monique. I feel like it's something that, like, we're all thinking about even before it's happened, and then the way it sort of ripples into the rest of the season is so profoundly fascinating to me. What was it like, or when did you get a call finding out what had happened?
It's actually a similar situation to the Hannah firing on Below Deck Med. Like that one, I got a call within a few minutes after the altercation. Yeah, so I was very aware of what went on. You know, it's funny, for someone who works at Bravo, I really don't like conflict. It makes me really uncomfortable because I
think you're an empath, Josh.
I kind of like everyone. So even at the reunion, if you could see me watching on the monitor, I just, you know, it's hard for me to watch. It's, you know, when I really like two people and to see them, you know, not getting along, it just makes me uncomfortable. And I really don't like a physical conflict. That's really upsetting. And it's something that the network really stands against. You know, again, I think there's this perception that this is something that we might enjoy somehow, but it's really not. We're really upset about it. And it's not something that we, you know, sort of want to glorify or give, you know, a sense that we're getting pleasure from it. It was just something that happened that we, because it affected all of the women, you know, for months and months. And I think to this day, it's something that we had to follow. And without understanding what actually happened there, all of the fallout would make no sense. So we kind of had no choice but to cover this story. And, you know, the one directive from Bravo that we gave the production company is to make sure that this is seen as documentary as possible. So we want people to see it, to be able to understand, you know, the women's, you know, emotions and mindsets.
Do you have a sense going into a season what side people are going to take? Or is there a side that would surprise you at this point?
We always have a sense, and usually the sense is wrong. You know what I mean? I mean, you always take guesses on where you feel like, you know, the viewer sentiment is going to lie. But, you know, oftentimes we're wrong. So, you know, the audience is sort of like the third leg of the tripod. You know, they're contributing to the conversation about how these shows are viewed. You just don't know. And there's so many small things that the viewer picks up on that, you know, that you don't think of when you're watching at the network or when you're at the production company putting the show together. You know, you sort of have a sense of what's going to be seen as funny or dramatic, but you don't always get it right.
What was more difficult, deciding how to handle this Candace Monique or the season 4 allegations against Michael Darby?
That's actually a good question. It's hard to compare the two, to be honest, because they're so different. You know, one, you know, obviously the altercation between Monique and Candace is something that happened between two cast members. You know, the allegations against Michael Darby was something that happened, you know, behind the scenes and not between, you know, Michael Darby is not a cast member. He's right. The husband of a cast member. So it's really hard to compare. They were both very difficult from a network perspective. You know, they're both things that in an ideal world, you know, maybe wouldn't be on the show just because it would make everyone's life easier who works on the show. But without seeing them, you know, the viewer wouldn't understand, you know, what's going on in the women's circle. Like there was just no way that we couldn't, you know, get into those stories.
Were you surprised that Ashley and Michael decided to come back this season?
No, I wasn't surprised because I think Ashley has a story to tell. You know, the story of her life is actually amazing. And I think she's someone that gets a lot out of sharing her story with the world. But would I have been surprised if they didn't come back? I also wouldn't have been surprised, you know, because she was having a baby and, you know, sometimes people need to make, you know, certain life choices for themselves. So I love Ashley. I'm supportive of whatever she does.
Yeah. I often, just as a viewer, feel like after a tough season, Housewives must come back as sort of their redemption season. So that was sort of my thinking at the beginning of this season. They're really going to try hard to put out this idea that they're a great, perfect couple. And then we got even more relationship drama from them. Was that surprising for you?
Not that surprising, to be honest, because we don't think of seasons, you know, working on the show. We don't think of, well, this was that season from Ashley and now she's going to be like this. You know, we try and think about her real life and what's really going on in her life. Like that's always what we're focused on and that's always what we want to show. And, you know, obviously we knew that Ashley was having a baby and just had a baby and we knew that, you know, that is always, you know, just a really wonderful, but also, you know, it can be a stressful time for a couple. And so Ashley is such a wonderful cast member. You know, she's so open to telling her story. So whatever is going on in her life, you know, she is open to sharing it, which, you know, I never stop appreciating. You know, as someone who is always behind the camera and not in front of the camera, I have no interest in being in front of the camera. I appreciate so much people sharing their stories on camera. It actually takes an incredible amount of bravery. Like I'm not sure how much viewers realize that. It's a really brave act to share, you know, particularly your family life. It's very, very brave.
Yes, absolutely. Is that something that is rare and that's why you showed it? Or are there a lot of moments like these with spouses that we don't necessarily see?
We're really focused on what is really happening. That is always the directive from the network to say, you know, were always questioning, well, how, you know, how did this really happen, or what really happened? What was the cast member really feeling here? Whenever we break the fourth wall on the show, like to show production behind the scenes, it's for a very specific reason, because we feel like without showing it, viewers won't understand what was really happening. Anytime we show that, it's because without that key piece of information, you're not going to really get the real story. And we always want to show the real story.
What do you think the reunion is going to be like this season?
I've been thinking about that ever since the production wrapped. I don't know. The reunion is a surprise every year on Potomac. Last year's was amazing. So I have no idea what's going to happen. I'm with the viewer on that one. All I know is that I'm going to be watching it, you know, sort of half shielding my eyes. But I really have no idea.
What is it like for you on reunion days? I mean, you clearly hate conflict, and that's just what reunions are. It's like a 12-hour conflict. So what are those days like for you?
Yeah, well, they're very long days. It's really fun because, you know, you're watching something that's unfolding live, and you know, to see all the women getting into their outfits and coming out on the set, and Andy is so fun. It's really amazing, but it is a very, very long day, and you know, they keep it very chilly in those facilities just
right.
Because there's so many hot lights. So usually you're just, you know, sort of shivering back in the control room wearing like, you know, a hat and a sweater or sweatshirt, and like trying to make it through all the drama.
Yes. If you had your wish, would you rather it be an in-person reunion or remote?
I mean, as long as it's safe, you would always want an in-person reunion, just because to be able to see, you know, the body language of when people interact, even if in the socially distant era, you know, two cast members are sitting 30 feet apart, you want to be able to see their body language with each other. But if it ends up having to be remote, I think it will be great too, because there's a lot that needs to be said, I think, from a lot of parties. So it will be amazing no matter how it's filmed.
So I think with Potomac, there have been some really great cast additions over the years. You know, I'm thinking about Monique and Candace and Wendy. What is it that made each of them, do you think, such important fixtures on the show?
Yeah, I mean, they all have been, you know, wonderful additions to the cast for sure. I think, I mean, first of all, they all came in to us and to the production organically. Like, that's amazing when that happens, when, you know, that there, you find out, oh, there is a real connection between these people, because it makes all the difference in the world. That's what, you know, I think makes Bravo special and Potomac special. And then each of them, I think, you know, the one common thing that they all have is being open to sharing their stories and their family life. Like, I know there's this feeling out there, particularly on social media, where it's like, oh, well, we're just going from one conflict between two housewives to the next and this and that. And that can be really tiring and boring if you don't care about these women as women and care about their families. Like, the family life and their personal lives is the key to the series. And for them to open up about that is brave, and it's critical to the health of a show like Potomac.
I think we were all very surprised to learn that Giselle has reunited with her ex, Jamal. And I'm now really curious to sort of dig into his life and his past and, you know, his other family members. Do you think that will ever happen? Or do you think Giselle and him will make the conscious choice to keep things more private?
I don't know the answer, to be honest. I think Giselle, you know, as a smart cast member, she agrees and knows how important, you know, sharing, you know, your family life, how important that is to a series like Potomac. And she and Jamal really have this year. You know, they have a long distance relationship, so we don't get to see him every day, but they really do have a long distance relationship. He lives in Atlanta and she lives in the Potomac area. So we're seeing the real dynamic of their relationship. But, you know, sort of like the yacht on Below Deck Med, you know, we always want to keep moving forward with story. So, you know, it's always my hope that in a new season, we're going to, you know, dive even deeper with each cast member and their personal story.
Is there any relationship that would really break your heart if it didn't work out on this show?
Like you're saying, I think I'm an empath and it would break my heart if any relationship didn't work out. Like I've become invested in their lives. I watch so many cuts. So I root for everyone. You know, I really root for everyone. So I couldn't choose, you know, maybe just because we've seen them from the beginning try and work it out. And now it seems like they're working it out. You know, Robin and Juan, that's such an amazing story. We have talked about their backstory on the show, but it's hard to really cover the emotional details of their past on a show like Housewives when we only have a certain number of minutes every week. But some viewers are probably aware, they've seen the whole series, but, you know, some might not remember that, you know, Juan was basically taken in by Robin's parents when they were teenagers. You know, his parents passed away, and so that's how he got to know Robin. You know, they were very young, and just, you know, all of the ups and downs they've had since then, it's so emotional.
Oh, seeing their therapy session this season was so good.
Yeah, that actually might be my most favorite Robin and Juan scene in series history, just because I feel like they really got to the core of their, you know, emotional truth there. It was really emotional to watch that.
Having a new housewife is always a gamble. What are your feelings about Wendy? Are you happy with her first season on Potomac?
Yes, very happy. You know, Wendy, you know, brings a really, you know, a new voice to Potomac. You know, she comes from a Nigerian background, which I think is really interesting. You know, she's a professor. She's a political pundit. She's an activist. Like, she's an amazing person. And she has three children and is an extremely, you know, busy woman. She checks the boxes for me. She's smart and she's funny and she's self-aware. And that's, you know, and she's open to sharing her story. And those are the things we look for. So I'm very happy with her. And, you know, obviously, you know, we filmed, you know, before, you know, the recent events, you know, in terms of what's going on with Black Lives Matter and social justice. And, you know, we had no idea that, you know, her activism would become so, you know, important out there in the world at the same time. So that's been interesting to see, but you know, she's a great addition.
And then I wanted to ask about Candace. You know, when you were deciding whether to bring her onto the show, had you already met her mother, Dorothy, or was Dorothy like this added bonus where you were like, oh my God, this is amazing?
I definitely had not met Dorothy. no, that turned out to be, you know, surprising to everyone, I think, on the production, you know, how unique their relationship is. They really do have a unique relationship. No, I had met Candace, but I had not met Dorothy. You know, Candace did share the details of her personal life and her backstory and her history. And she, you know, she's talked about on the show, she has a really interesting history. So that's something that we found interesting.
I want to also talk about Summer House, because I am so excited for this show to come back. How are you guys dealing with shooting Summer House in a COVID era?
We always want to show what's really happening. And on Summer House, strangely, the concept of the show kind of plays into what's really going on in the world. So, you know, I've read about, there are a lot of people in their 20s and 30s in particular who, you know, might have roommates, for example. And, you know, when you're quarantining or when you're in lockdown or that sort of thing in this COVID era, you know, your family is really your friends. And so, you know, that is the case with Summer House. You know, they are coming to the house to all live together and to quarantine together safely. And, you know, they really are a family, especially at this point. You know, they may be, some of them may be fighting like brothers and sisters, but they are a family. And so instead of going back and forth to the city, they are living together all through the summer in the Hamptons in their, you know, summer rental. And I think it really taps into a phenomenon right now of how do you quarantine with friends and how do you get along with them kind of as a family? And that's what we're going to see this summer on Summer House. And I think it's actually going to be our best season yet. ironically, even with these limitations.
So working on Summer House, I am curious how you guys decided to balance the moments when they're working in the city and when they're having long weekends at the Summer House.
That's been one of the biggest things that we've, you know, worked on over the years, is trying to find that balance. It's never easy because, you know, these are real New Yorkers and, you know, people who have jobs and, you know, entrepreneurs, you know, like Kyle and Amanda, who have started Loverboy, and now Carl is working with Loverboy. You know, they all have jobs, they all have lives in the city, but, you know, that's something that it's hard to capture on camera in an interesting way. Like if you're someone might have an amazing job, you know, let's say for a bank or something like that. But, you know, how interesting is that to see them in front of a computer? So we always want to give kind of just enough of a sense of that these are real people, work hard, play hard kind of people who then come out to the Hamptons without it, you know, sort of slowing down the fun energy of the series. So it's always a balance that we try and get right, but it's admittedly, you know, it's not something that's the easiest thing in the world.
Can you think of one moment maybe that happened either during the week or outside of filming that you're like, oh, I wish we had gotten that on camera?
You know, one thing that pops to mind is, you know, obviously we found out that Carl and Lindsay, you know, kind of hooked up before last season. So obviously we would have wanted to, you know, be there that weekend. I think Carl and Lindsay were there. I think Carl's mom was around from what I recall. So that would have been like really interesting and fun. But on the other hand, it was really real the way, you know, the rest of the cast found out. You know, Kyle knew about it from Carl, and then Kyle told Amanda, and then it took off from there, and we just followed it. So it still worked out, but, you know, would have been interesting to find out how that all went down.
Right. What do you think the future holds for Kyle and Amanda?
I think only Kyle and Amanda know. I think no one knows, you know, when they're in a relationship and they're, you know, headed towards marriage. I mean, you know, one thing I know is that they have grown a lot through the years, both individually and as a couple. And so I think they're in a much more centered place now, in a much better place. And they're working together and they're living together. So, you know, I wish them all the best.
I'm curious not only about the future of this show, but all of the Bravo shows. I'm going to ask a question that I think a lot of fans are asking right now. What's the future of Bravo in this pandemic? You know, are we still going to get our favorite shows? Is it going to be the same? What's your prediction?
Let's put it this way. I'm no more worried about Bravo than I'm worried about the world. You know, I think we're all, you know, anxious right now and taking it one week at a time. So certainly, you know, at Bravo, you know, we don't know what the future is going to hold just because we don't know where the world is going. But the one thing I do know is that everyone is really dedicated to making these series and to making them happen. So, you know, safety is our number one priority. And, you know, if we can do things safely, we will do them.
What is your favorite thing about your job?
I can't just limit it to one. I'm, you know, probably two things are, number one, that I get to work with series and material that has, you know, humor to it. Like I'm just laughing all day, you know, at, you know, like I was just thinking about, you know, Karen Huger's interview bites on Potomac. Like, you know, she always makes me laugh. She's so funny. To be able to get to watch and work with that material is a real treat. And I feel very lucky. I don't think I've been bored once, you know, at my job. My job is never boring. There's always something strange and new that pops up. You know, there's so many different aspects of putting these shows together, and so many surprises and so many things just pop up and bubble up, and you're like, wait, what just happened, or what do I have to deal with now? It's like a constant roller coaster, and it, you know, it becomes kind of an addiction. It's hard to stop once you get on that ride.
What is your least favorite thing about your job?
That's a good question. Nobody's ever asked me that before. I think the most difficult thing is when I have to give news to someone that I know will not make them happy, but I still have to give it to them because it's, you know, I'm representing the voice of the network and I need to tell them something. That's always tough.
Is it a conversation such as, we don't think you should come back this season?
That might be one, but, you know, there might be things that have happened that I need to tell them about, or, you know, I might need to give them an answer. You know, they might have had a question asking about something or hoping something, and I need to tell them that it's not possible, and I need to tell them why. There's all sorts of different conversations that I need to have that are tough. You know, I always try and be forthright and honest, and I tell them, you know, as much as I can tell them about what's going on. And if I can't tell them something, I tell them why I can't tell them that. But, you know, it can be tough sometimes.
Who is the easiest Bravo celebrity you've had to work with?
I don't think I can choose just one person. Let's just say this. You might be surprised about who are the easier people and who are the harder people to work with.
You
know, sometimes the people who seem more fiery on TV are, you know, easier to work with than some of the more easygoing people.
Very interesting.
I'm pretty lucky. I feel fortunate that the cast that I have worked with are overall like really actually wonderful to work with. So, you know, I'm happy about the relationships that I've developed over the years with some of these casts. Good questions.
No, I try.
Rose and Thorn.
Okay, let's do Rose and Thorn.
Oh, my Rose was that we got a look at Erica's dog, Tiago, and the Real Housewives of Beverly Hills reunion. I just love that someone who looks like Erica has a dog like that. Like, and I think we have a video on BravoTV.com, but it's like a military-trained dog. I mean, definitely a sweetie pie, but could kill you probably.
They've got some really good dogs on Beverly Hills, I must say. I love, like, Kyle's dogs. I love Tiago.
What was your Rose?
My Rose is two things, actually, from Below Deck Med, and it is Michelle Damon's obsession with Aisha. She like tackled her at the pool party. She carried her out on her back. She was like flirting with her after dinner. She hugged her the next morning. I was just like, I love this. What's the opposite of a bromance?
Oh.
A cis man? A lady manse. We'll call it a lady manse. And then second part from Below Deck Med is Bugsy and Alex finally making out.
Bye-bye, friend zone.
It's been a long time coming.
I know. And even if it doesn't work out, which I don't think it's going to, I'm just glad that she finally let him have a smooch, because that's all he's been after for a while now.
Do you think that's all he's after, Eric?
No, definitely not. But like, that's the first step, at least. He's closest as he's ever been. Okay, what was your thorn?
Okay, so also from Below Deck Med is, again, Jess is being kind of a crazy girlfriend. Like, she won't even let her boyfriend talk to Aisha without getting upset. But I will also say I was upset with him for asking her, what, are you threatened? It's like, duh, obviously she's threatened. You don't have to call it out. All you're going to do is make her more mad.
So at this point, are we just looking for things to get upset about?
I was in a conversation.
I am so sorry that you were so involved in that conversation.
Why are you shouting at me?
I'm not.
You are. Do you feel threatened or something?
I don't give a
Yeah, this is quickly starting to crumble, and I loved the conversation that Aisha had with Jess when they were doing like turndowns, and something came up about like, well, did you say I love you? When I think Jess was asking Aisha about Jack last season, and she was like, no, we've only known each other for 6 weeks. And she was like, did you? And Jess is like, yeah. Aisha's like, what? Like,
yeah.
You know, it's just so funny because I think everybody was so on board with Aisha and Jack last year, and we really thought that there was some promise there, and then it fell apart off camera, but we're actually watching Jess and Rob fall apart on camera this season.
Absolutely. What was your thorn?
My thorn is actually that I could not participate in the pancake battle between Monique and Giselle, because I think that my breakfast making skills, my pancake making skills specifically, are pretty on point. And I think I could have really entered this battle in a way that would have provided aesthetically pleasing pancakes on top of deliciously tasting ones. So
Make me pancakes.
Okay. I'm telling you, we need to do a group trip together, because you can go get the booze the night before, we'll get drunk, then we'll get up, and when we're hungover, I'll make pancakes.
Okay. And then we'll get in a huge fight and like record the whole thing.
Yes. I'm down. And we'll be back with an all new episode next Saturday.
Bye.
Megan, you're from Texas. How big is football there?
Well, how about them Cowboys is a real thing. Like, that is something that just is ingrained in conversation, I will say.
Well, Texans rejoice because Dak Prescott's Cowboys are visiting Aaron Donald and the Rams' new home on the season premiere of Sunday Night Football. That's this Sunday at 7 p.m. Eastern on NBC.
Season premiere? Wait, does that mean there's going to be a reunion episode? 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 9. And remember, watching Bravo isn't a guilty pleasure.
It's self-care.
Guys, let's keep the conversation going. We want to talk to you all week long. You can find us on Instagram at Bravo Daily Dish.
And on Twitter at Bravo TV. Just don't forget to use the hashtag Bravo Daily Dish.
Or reach out to us personally. I'm everywhere at Meg Segura.
And I'm everywhere at Eric J. Mack. That's E-R-I-K.
And if you're on Facebook, join the Daily Dish Facebook group.
You can post about what you're watching, your favorite shows, who's your favorite housewife, ask a question, start some drama. There's a lot of good stuff in there, so check it out.
You can also learn more about the podcast at bravotv.com.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
Looking fine, and I got my girls with me. With the boys at the table getting tipsy, miss me, kiss me.